This is episode number 7 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, April 5th, 2007. I'm Jerry Brito. Up for discussion this week, the NAB lobbies hard against the SiriusXM merger. Apple gets EMI to drop DRM under digital music. Verizon changes its wireless broadband terms of service. And the FCC will soon deliver its report to Congress on TV violence. Joining me to discuss these topics are Tech Liberation Front contributors. First of all, we've got Braden Cox of the Association for Competitive Technology.
Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Braden. You got Andrew Grossman of the Heritage Foundation.
Hello.
Hello. And Adam Thierer of the Progress and Freedom Foundation.
Hi, Jerry.
Hello, Adam. Our guest this week is Tim Carney, a columnist for The Examiner, a daily paper here in D.C. Glad to have you with us, Tim.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Jerry.
That's great. Well, first up, Tim, the National Association for Broadcasters takes on Sirius and XM. Tim, you wrote your column this week on the topic. What is the NAB doing?
Well, the National Association of Broadcasters has been hiring some top-notch, top-name lobbyists to petition Capitol Hill and the FCC and the Federal Trade Commission against allowing the merger of XM and Sirius. Now, the interesting sort of ironies and twists to this story are, one, NAB is huge compared to XM and Sirius. In fact, NAB's biggest member, Clear Channel Broadcasting, makes more in a quarter than XM and Sirius make combined in a year, and that they are using antitrust laws against smaller businesses. I wrote in the article, Teddy Roosevelt and Senator John Sherman might be surprised to see how their antitrust laws are being used today. But beyond that, the crux of their argument is that if XM and Sirius join, they become a monopoly and they will have no competitors in their industry. And it makes you wonder, why do the broadcasters care about this merger, about this powerful monopoly, unless a powerful new competitor. So it seems to me proof that satellite radio has competition in terrestrial radio, that they're spending so much. They're spending so much they hired John Ashcroft, and there was a report in the Wall Street Journal that Ashcroft actually called the satellite companies to offer his services. When they declined, he then went to work for the broadcasters. There's also a they've also hired a group called the Carmel Group, which is a top price group that helped the broadcasters block a satellite television merger a couple years back. And so this lobbying campaign could end up, if they succeed and they block the merger, we don't know what's going to happen. XM and Sirius, through bad business decisions in part, might go out of business if they don't get to merger. And then how can anyone argue that that's good for consumers? So it's another case of what I'm always talking about, which is big businesses using big government to kill off smaller competitors, and that being to the detriment of the consumers.
Tim, you know, the broadcasters in the past haven't been shy about making the argument that their service is a public service that needs to be protected, and it basically say we need protection from competition. Have they been making that argument, or have they been sticking to this monopoly argument?
They've been sticking to the monopoly argument because they don't want to admit that they are being threatened by the satellite companies. Because if they admit that, then they're admitting that the satellite companies are competitors, which pulls the rug out from under their from under them. Now, can the satellite companies argue that they're a public service and use the broadcaster's argument again? I don't know. Maybe they could if they are exclusive. If they provide something that nobody else does, which would be to say, if they're a separate industry, then perhaps they could make that argument. But right now, it's Sirius and XM arguing we will actually help the consumers if we are allowed to merge. Prices will go down. And frankly, one of us or both of us will go out of business if we're not allowed to merge. And how does that help consumers?
You know, Tim, this is Adam. The point you're making is an important one, and it's one that our own Tim Lee on the Tech Liberation Front has made many times on our blog, which is the preposterous notion that the NAB is putting forward that somehow you know, this creates a monopoly, then why are they so concerned about it, is what you're saying. And that's been my experience in the past as well with other sorts of things the NAB has pushed. They have pushed quite aggressively in Congress for a bill called the Local Emergency Radio Service Preservation Act, which would basically make it a crime for XM or Sirius to provide local news, weather, or sports to local communities in America in direct competition with terrestrial broadcasters. That bill had almost 80 sponsors in the last session of Congress. Most of them were Republicans. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's about as shameless of an example of market protectionism as you can find. Why is it that the broadcasters, if they fear that these guys are not competitors, would want a bill that would restrict them from competing against them?
Yeah,
so, I mean, it's absolutely crazy, but it's another example of what you're saying, that they really are competitors and they're quite scared of this new threat.
And I'm not confident that this merger is going to be allowed to go through. I mean, what you've got in the FTC and the FCC are regulators who like to regulate. And unless you can sort of, you just say, look, just leave us alone, we're an industry, it's not going to work. Unfortunately, the satellite companies have to do this sort of, we are helping the consumers, we are going to make this promise or make that promise. And they just simply don't have the clout that the broadcasters have. And, I mean, in the past, the broadcasters helped limit the micro-broadcasters, the smaller radio stations operating over shorter distances. NAB helped limit them. This is not a group that shies from using big government to help keep out competition.
Right. Now, Tim, I would say there's one additional interesting bit of cognitive dissonance here. The NAB has worked so hard in recent decades to relax local ownership restrictions and, you know, going on and on about the economies of scale and how when they own multiple stations, when a single company owns multiple stations, they can really help that locality. Now it seems they're really arguing on the other side right now.
Yeah, Clear Channel is a perfect case in point of how consolidation can help make things better. I mean, obviously, Clear Channel has lots of enemies, partly on the political left, partly among people who just don't like to see that consolidation. But it's hard for anybody to point to real disadvantages that consumers have gotten from there being this mega company that sort of can be vertical and horizontal, not monopoly, but just a titan. And so that is definitely one thing that some of the congressmen brought up when they heard the NAB complaining about how big this Sirius XM company would be, was saying, hey, what you're talking about sounds like Clear Channel, and you guys have always argued that this consolidation has helped consumers. And so, I said in my Examiner column that Sirius and XM should point to Clear Channel and say, this is an example of how consolidation can be beneficial. All this, I haven't yet seen Clear Channel itself as a company come out against the merger. But
no, they haven't. It's actually been all done through the NAB. I know that for a fact.
And but the point, biggest member, but yeah.
Right. But no, Tim and Andrew, the point you guys both were making there was really important, I think, because you know what's happening now is the broadcasters are still petitioning Congress and the FCC quite aggressively for further relaxation of the extensive spider web of media ownership rules that encumber this industry. And the problem is, if they effectively block XM and Sirius from merging, they will essentially be shooting themselves in the foot because no one's going to grant them any additional regulatory or antitrust release ever again if they don't have serious competition from XM and Sirius to say, look, these guys are there as a threat to us. If they successfully sabotage this deal, they can kiss any chance of further media ownership reform goodbye for maybe 5 to 10 years, if not longer.
And that might actually be good, again, for Clear Channel, because they're already by far the biggest guy on the block. And for anybody else to compete with them, they would need to do the sort of consolidation, purchasing, and merging that Clear Channel has done. So if we get any restrictions on radio, broadcast radio consolidation, heck, that's just pulling up the ladder behind Clear Channel.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Tim. Next up, EMI drops its DRM in Apple's iTunes Store. Brad, tell us a bit about what happened.
Sure. This has been a big week. Earlier this week, music label EMI announced that it would sell songs on Apple's iTunes without digital rights management. And yesterday, Microsoft said it would do the same thing for its Zune marketplace and try to work a deal with EMI as well. I don't think any of them are going to be successful in getting Beatles music out there, which is still something that isn't even offered with DRM or not DRM. But I do think it is evidence that the market is working here, albeit perhaps slowly and too slowly for lots of people. But I think we're really trying to figure out, hey, what is it that consumers want? At what price point do they want it at? And at what quality? The interesting thing about the EMI deal is that perhaps this is to make it seem like consumers are actually getting more for their money than they actually would just by instead of just saying that, hey, you have more rights to it digitally. They're going to make the bit rate of the music that you download double. They're going to double it to 256 kilobits per second, which might make a difference on some people's stereos. I know just the standard 128 MP3 on a lot of people's home stereos doesn't sound so great at all. And so this might be a win in both quality and with the ability to do with it with what you want. But I know there are going to be some naysayers out there that say that DRM shouldn't be around anyway, so consumers are paying more for something that they should already have. However, I would like to look optimistically here. I think that you know, consumers will decide with their dollars, and we need more of these options.
You know, one thing that I see happening with this deal is that before this deal, all songs on the iTunes stores on the iTunes store was 99 cents each, and Steve Jobs was very adamant about keeping it a flat rate, while the record companies wanted to have variable pricing, basically charge a little bit more for the hot new single, a little less than 99 cents for the oldie. And what this does, there are all sorts of different prices now. You've got 99 cents for a regular DRM song, $1.39 for without DRM, then but you can still buy it at the regular price, even if it doesn't have DRM. All these different options. What do you think about that? Is this a Trojan horse where now the record companies can get the variable pricing in the stores?
You know, I guess they're going to figure out a way somehow. I mean, the fact is that they've always done this in the offline world. The certain CDs were a little bit more than others. Generally, I think they tried to keep it the same as well. You know, usually CDs are within a couple dollars of each other, I think, even no matter if some are very popular or not. It comes down to kind of economics and for them deciding what's the appropriate price point. But I think it's more flexible when it's online. They can change things on demand. I mean, I don't know why it wouldn't be possible. It'd be great to see some sort of almost eBay kind of like reputation or song feedback system and the price increases or decreases based on what consumers are actually doing with it and purchasing. But, you know, that's perhaps the world of the future. I think this is a good foray. I like the fact that you can have different quality songs and pay more for that. I think that I'm one of those people that likes to listen to songs I download in my home stereo, and I can't stand the shrill sometimes that I hear through the speakers.
So, guys, let me ask all of you, what happened to the notion espoused by, you know, some, even on Tech Liberation, that Apple was really liking the DRM, if only because it locks in their consumers to the iPod? Basically, iTunes was a loss leader that they didn't mind because it locked people into the iPod.
I always thought that was a naive view for the reason that so many people who own iPods never even use the iTunes Music Store, and the ones who do use it tend to buy very few songs. You have so many more songs being downloaded from other sources and ripped from CDs. The iTunes Music Store, while attractive, clearly was never what was driving sales.
So I guess we'll see more record companies come in if they see EMI making more money without DRM.
I mean, potentially, you know, this could sort of turn around to help Apple in another way. If it sort of draws other online music stores to take this route and to put out more MP3s and more unprotected songs, that could be more content that eventually finds its way onto the iPod.
And remember, too, Jerry, in a way, it was also the record companies themselves that was pushing DRM onto Apple, and that's the only way they could strike the deal to offer this library of music that they have now. And so the fact that the music producers are feeling differently now, you know, allows Apple to kind of have more flexibility too, I think. But you're right; it doesn't address maybe the tying situation that you have with the iPod and iTunes.
But it does show that the market worked, and if in fact the record companies could make more money and make their customers more, you know, happier without the DRM, it's happening slowly,
yeah.
Like you said, but it's happening.
Well, I think so.
Well, my question is, do consumers care? I mean, we've read a lot about this online, but looking through major media outlets, I've seen very little coverage of this. It's not like when Apple's released a new product or even when they've had a big addition to their music store. You have Cory Doctorow starting out his post on this saying, hallelujah. Do many people offline, people who don't read Gizmodo and people who don't read Boing Boing, does it matter to them? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I'll represent the regular guy here. I think it does matter in creating sort of a bad taste in people's mouth, people who have gotten the iTunes and they sort of feel like Steve Jobs is now the big brother looking over their shoulder. It definitely creates a sense of sort of a paternalism almost, even if you signed up for this, yeah, I bought this, but I would like to be more free. So it is a liberating feeling to get to do whatever you want with your songs, and so it's not a huge thing. I doubt it was a big barrier to sales, but depending on what sort of competition was going to come up down the line for the iPod, this definitely helps remove some of the bad taste that some iPod consumers had.
All right. Well, next up we're going to talk about Verizon changing its wireless broadband terms. Andrew, tell us what happened and what does this have to do with net neutrality?
Now, what happened is that Verizon, which is the largest provider of wireless broadband services with its broadband access service, recently changed its terms of service. Now, let me just read this very briefly. Anyone using more than 5 gigabytes per line in a given month, that's 5 gigabytes of bandwidth, is presumed to be using the service in a manner prohibited, and we reserve the right to immediately terminate the service. And even more specifically, Verizon's new terms of service bans uploading of server files, any kind of peer-to-peer sharing, potentially different kinds of streaming audio and video programming. It's very sloppily drafted. It's difficult to tell exactly what's permitted and what's not permitted, but a lot of people are concerned because this is something that could really affect a lot of applications, even people just browsing on the internet. Now, the way that which this gets to net neutrality, it really hits straight to the core of the idea. The FCC's 4 principles from 2005, one of them is allowing customers to access any sort of lawful internet content that they choose to, and another is to run any application that they want. Obviously, Verizon's sort of metering of their service here and then blocking several specific services sort of flies in the face of that. Now, the interesting thing is people have been calling them out on it. You've got sort of the standard sort of file sharing sites like TorrentFreak raising a ruckus over the matter. But if someone who's used the service a bit, it kind of makes sense. It's sort of just coming online. They're auguring for business customers. And they're in the process right now of a huge network upgrade to basically triple the speed of their network. Do they have the capacity for people to be using peer-to-peer, for them to be using BitTorrent on the network? It doesn't seem like it yet. Slowdowns are unfortunately normal. So you can see where Verizon's coming from on this, but like many things in the past few months, it seems like it might be another issue that might sort of take the net neutrality genie out of the bottle and really revive the debate.
So besides the PR aspect of this, where you feel like you're advertised unlimited internet access, and then you end up with something that's really quite restricted. Putting that aside, these restrictions make sense because without these restrictions, Verizon might not be able to provide the service at that cost.
Right, exactly. The costs are surprisingly reasonable compared to prior data services. At somewhere between $70 and $80 per month, that's about a third of what one might have paid a year or two ago for a service that was much slower. And as I said, they're upgrading it and prices are still dropping. I'm not sure you could necessarily expect that to be happening with the sort of bandwidth that peer-to-peer applications would draw. And with respect to sort of the unlimited service, I think they've gotten the message on that. Looking through their site earlier today, they're slowly changing that. They still say unlimited in a couple places, but it looks like they're taking that out.
You know, I think this reflects something we've talked a lot about on the blog, which is this question about how do you deal with bandwidth hogs regardless of what network you're talking about. And this has been something that they've tried to deal with in the wired broadband context, Comcast and their cable operators, because of the concern that a very, very small handful of very intense broadband users are eating up the vast majority of the bandwidth, and degrading the overall network experience for others because of the shared nature of the cable architecture or network. Well, that's a real serious problem. I mean, what we're talking about here is a network congestion issue in classic economic terms, and how do you deal with someone who hogs up more of a service or a good than everyone else? So far, though, for the most part, this has been a lot of talk and little action, because even though the terms of service say things like, well, we can cut you off after a certain limit or you reach it, the reality is that for the most part, these companies just send people a dirty letter here and there and say, please stop using so much bandwidth or we'll say stop again. And they don't really do anything to follow that up. The question then becomes, why don't they? Why don't they cut off service? There have been a few select case studies of people getting cut off that I can find. But why don't they do something like meter pricing? Why don't they just say you can use up to 5 gigs on the EVDO network, but after that, maybe we charge you a metered rate for however much more you consume over that limit? That's the model we use in many other economic contexts for many other types of goods and services when there's a congestion problem. But for whatever reason, broadband providers, be they wired or wireless, seem obsessed with the notion of saying they provide an unlimited, all-you-can-eat buffet-style pricing of service, when in reality, they have to impose some limits at some point. They just don't want to say so. The problem for Verizon here is that they continue to say that it's unlimited when it really isn't an unlimited service, and they're going to have to change that at some point.
All right.
Go
ahead.
Well, I can certainly see why they have to change it. You know, from behavioral economics, you can clearly see why customers may not like that. The fact is, for the vast, vast majority of customers, I don't know about this particular plan, but most broadband service is unlimited. It's more than they could ever possibly use. It's a percentage or two of users who reach those limits.
Right.
Well, before we move on, I want to do a quick plug for our listeners who have the Verizon service, who want to tell us what they think about it or anything else we've been talking about. Please go to techliberation.com/podcast, and on that page you can post a comment and have a discussion with us on these topics. So finally, we're going to talk about the FCC, who will soon be delivering a report to Congress on TV violence. And Adam, you've been following this closely. What's FCC doing?
Well, Jerry, the FCC is very close to releasing a major report about the question of excessive violence on television, including not just broadcast television, but cable and satellite television. The Congress several years ago asked the FCC to conduct a report and look into this matter, and now finally the FCC is getting around to issuing that report, and it appears that all 5 FCC commissioners will vote in favor of the report, which apparently will say, when it comes out within the next week or two, that Congress should consider potentially taking steps to allow the FCC more leeway to regulate, quote-unquote, excessive violence as if it's indecent content on broadcast television. Further, the report will apparently tee up this issue for cable and satellite and basically say, since 86% of all homes have cable and satellite television, we now have to somehow regulate that as well, even though obviously the constitutional issues there are even stickier than they would be for broadcasting. But that's probably part of a broader agenda of Kevin Martin, the FCC chairman, and others to push what's called a la carte regulation of cable television. So this may be their way of sort of forcing a quid pro quo on cable to say, you either agree to have your content regulated by us, or you agree to sell your channels on an a la carte basis. So this is going to be a big deal. The report should be out within the next 2 weeks, and I assume it will lead to an immediate introduction of legislation within Congress, probably by Senator John Rockefeller, who introduced a similar piece of legislation last session that would apply FCC regulation, indecency-like regulation, to excessive violent content, and then apply it to cable and satellite as well.
Adam, hasn't this been decided constitutionally by the Supreme Court? Isn't this a done deal, or
is this
an opportunity for it to be revisited?
Well, it generally speaking, you're right. But the fact is that we've never seen Congress grant the FCC formal authority to regulate violent programming on television. And so technically speaking, it hasn't necessarily been tested, although it's been tested indirectly in other ways. And most recently, it's been tested indirectly in the context of video games, where you've had 10 major court decisions about supposedly excessive violent content video games. Every one of them have gone against the government and in favor of the video game industry on First Amendment grounds. So there are certainly other contexts, including movies and video games, where the government's got a very tough case to make in terms of the constitutionality of this, because when you get right down to it, there's no doubt about it, there's a lot of ambiguity about what constitutes excessive violence.
You know, Saving Private Ryan, that was a classic case study that's already the FCC's looked at and said, is that something that's excessively violent? And they've said no, because the context of it was that it was based on real life events and it was a historical film directed by a famous award-winning director. So they said in that case, we'll let it go. But other cases, you know, would natural born killers pass the test? Probably not. And then you get into more technical questions like, okay, maybe we're not going to try to ban that content from television altogether. Maybe we're going to try to, quote unquote, channel it to a, quote, safe harbor, like, say, sometime after 10 o'clock at night. But does that really make sense, especially in a cable context where you pay to bring content into your homes and then you have to wait for it longer? I mean, am I going to wait around until after 10 o'clock to watch every movie or show I want? So that's a secondary question. So there's the first question, can the government regulate this content? Then there's a secondary question, which is, even if they can't regulate it directly, can they regulate it indirectly by having essentially a time, place, and manner restriction on when it can be shown?
Tim, you're a new dad. What do you think about all this?
Well, I'll lay out a series of questions, too. Does TV violence have an effect on children and on society, on adults too? I think yes. Is there legitimate government authority, both constitutional and just from a question of, is it morally legitimate for the government to limit violence on TV? There I would come down on along the broadcast cable lines and say, over broadcast, if the federal government wants to push the violence back past 9:30 p.m. or past 10 p.m., that would be within the government's authority because of all the favors. I mean, this is why you guys love these tech issues so much, because there's not these clear cut and dried what's government intervention, what's not questions. The government is completely embedded, involved with broadcast television in a way it isn't necessarily with cable, as you're pointing out. And
yeah,
that one final point is, as a new dad, I do also think that most of the people calling for these regulations are sort of misplacing where the responsibility lies to keep children away from this violence, and that a lot of people are shirking their parental duties and expecting Washington to cover it for them.
Tim, you make a lot of good points there and raise some good questions. I think they're the kind of questions that are going to be raised in this debate. I think clearly that first question you raised about, you know, what is the relationship between violent programming and actual real-world violence is a really sticky one, and there's been debates that have raged for decades about that question. And the problem is that a lot of that research, in my personal opinion, has been very politicized because it's driven largely by government funding, by people who essentially want the results to say, oh yeah, look, there's a connection. And when you dig beneath the surface and look at some of that research, you really do wonder, like, is this what actually is happening? I mean, is it a monkey see, monkey do kind of thing? I don't have time to get into all of that, but I will just point out one simple statistic, which is that over the past 10 years, a period during which I think everyone can agree exposure to media in general has been rising and exposure to probably violent media has probably been rising, over the last 10-year period, juvenile violence in this country has dropped by 39%. And so those who would support the thesis that there is a strict correlation or connection between exposure to media violence and real-world violence have to answer the question, how is it that real-world violence has plummeted at a time when exposure to potentially violent media has been increasing, both on television and in video games? So that would, you know, I'm not saying that completely debunks the issue that there's a connection. There can be. Maybe that percentage should be even lower. Maybe we would have had a 70% reduction in juvenile violence without any exposure to media content. The problem is we just don't know. This is complicated stuff.
Maybe but, violent TV is the only way to keep these criminals off the street.
Well,
that's
a different angle and one I haven't explored. But let me address your second question, which is that, well, it's okay to do this for broadcasting but not for cable. At some point, that becomes a sort of silly regulatory regime because, quite frankly, let's face it, kids are bolting away from broadcast television in massive numbers. They are watching television just about everywhere except for on old-fashioned broadcast television these days. And if that's the only thing that the FCC has authority over in the name of protecting children, then increasingly it's quite silly because most of the regulation is protecting adults from themselves. I mean, kids are overwatching stuff on YouTube or on satellite television or on any other type of media device. And one wonders, what's the point? I mean, realistically, my kids, I mean, I don't think they're going to spend any time when they get to be in their teens watching any television on broadcast TV. They'll watch it in other ways. So either we have to make a choice here. We either have to level the playing field by regulating up and treating everyone like broadcasters in order to, quote-unquote, protect the children, or we're going to have to take a different approach, which is grant broadcasting comparable regulatory treatment, or First Amendment freedom, that is, to cable and satellite. That's tough for a lot of people to swallow. But at some point, the regulations just aren't going to make sense when we're not really protecting kids anymore by regulating broadcasting.
But this, and that's the way it often works with technology, where the technology makes regulations irrelevant, or regulations steer technology in a particular way to make the regulations irrelevant. And this is one reason I like regulating broadcast and not the others, is hopefully broadcast will be irrelevant and most information will be passed in places that the government has its hands off of.
But the only problem with that, Tim, is that basically that's the government issuing essentially a death warrant to a certain type of media in this country and saying, guess what, you're screwed. You have to live with a certain set of rules that none of your competitors have to live with.
Yeah.
I mean, one wonders, is that fair under the First Amendment or under just basic norms of good rule of law, you know, government?
Adam, that's going to have to be the last word that you're going to get. We've grown a little long today, but I think it was well worth it. So that's going to be it for this week's Tech Policy Weekly. Thanks to all of you guys for joining us. We got Brad and Cox, Andrew Grossman, Adam Thier, and Tim Carney especially for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Gary.
To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this show. If you'd like what you heard, please tell a friend. Please review the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. Goodbye.